Good. And let's proceed to Hicks versus the Armed Forces Bank.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Steve Mulligan, Biggins, Carroll, and Barber on behalf of David and Connie Hicks. My registration number is number 19901. We have asserted four issues on appeal. Two of them relate to the waiver of the protections afforded by 38106 of the Colorado Revised Statutes. And the third one is the denial of the motion to allow the Hicks to amend their answer to assert a counterclaim. And the fourth issue is the denial of the motion to compel production of documents. My main focus today will be on the first two issues on the waiver under 38108106. I will be trying to save some time at the end for rebuttal, so I will watch my time accordingly. Under Colorado Revised Statute 38108106, in a foreclosure situation, a lender is required to bid what they believe to be the good faith estimate of fair value. This is a mandatory statute. It's not discretionary. The trial court found that it could be waived, and indeed had been waived by the Hicks. In coming to that conclusion, the trial court looked at the waiver language in the loan documents they issued here and found that they were broad enough to include a waiver of that provision. The court relied on the decision in the federal court of the FDIC versus Lichtenfels. That is an unpublished decision, and it is a federal court decision, but it did deal with the issue of waiver under 38108106, and the court did rely on it. In Lichtenfels, you had a very similar situation. The FDIC foreclosed, submitted a bid, and the borrowers in that case argued that the bid was too low. The Lichtenfels court did look at the waiver language in those particular documents and decided that they were narrowly drawn and didn't include a waiver. The Lichtenfels court did actually go a bit further, though, and said even if we were to accept the FDIC's position that it was broad enough to include a waiver, no language could be used to avoid the statutory law or the case law to bid an appropriate bid at a foreclosure.
Let me ask you about that for a moment, counsel. What Judge Raj said exactly is this. The requirement of good faith, quote, is not so readily waived, right? Even if the note in the contract of guarantee could be read as the FDIC suggests, no language in these documents can permit a lender to disregard both Colorado statutory and case law. It seems to me that Judge Raj may not have been going saying as broadly as you stated it, because he says the language in these documents, seemingly referring back to his already concluded position.
I agree. You obviously quote that opinion right by Judge Rod, and I do think there's a misinterpretation, perhaps, of the Lichtenfels decision, because the court had looked at the Lichtenfels release language and it determined it wasn't broad enough. But I don't tie those two statements in saying, okay, then we can look at it and saying that specific language doesn't contain a waiver of the 38108106 requirements. But I look at the Lichtenfels decision as saying that regardless of what is contained in the documents, you still have to comply with Colorado law, either statutory or case law, and that you can't be allowed to essentially impose upon a borrower the granting permission to the lender to not follow Colorado law. That's almost what we're having here.
Let me look at it from a slightly different angle. It appears to me that the legislature, even in this title, knows how and when to get involved and to bar waivers. For instance, in 38703, it's titled No Waiver of or Agreement to Shorten Right to Cure. And to summarize it, it says a waiver of or agreement to shorten the time period to exercise the right to cure a default, .. shall be void as against public policy. But we don't have that kind of language here.
We don't, Your Honor. And I would suggest to the court that the reason why we don't have it is because it's not necessary in this provision, because this is a requirement imposed upon the lender. Whereas the example you just said is a right for the borrower to cure under certain periods of time. And if the language in there says, okay, well, you can't impose upon somebody to shorten that. Whereas this is from the other side. The lender is required to bid of good faith estimate of fair value. And so I would suggest that you actually don't need to have a non-waiver language in the statute to govern that.
Well, wait, but the last sentence of the statute, our statute, says the failure of the holder to bid does not affect the validity of the sale, right? But may be raised as a defense. And may, I would assume you would agree, is a voluntary, not a mandatory, which is a mandatory action.
Yes.
In other words, the person who sued on the commission may or may not raise the defense.
That is discretionary, Your Honor.
So it's not that much unlike the statute that Judge Roman cited, where they may try to cure a default, or they may not. Here, they may or they may not assert a defense.
Then,
and yet the legislature didn't say they may not assert. They didn't fire the banks from, or they didn't make it mandatory, or they didn't bar the lender from seeking to bargain away his right, as they did over in the other statute.
Understood, Your Honor. But I still say it is discretionary upon the borrower to assert the defense of a low bid.
Therefore, isn't it also in the proceeding, right? I mean, it's pretty clear from the statute. When a bank brings a deficiency action, the borrower or the person they're seeking the deficiency against, in this case the guarantor, can waive this defense. It's pretty clear from the statute, right?
Well, it's not to me a waiver. It's just I guess it's different. You either waive it in the loan documents up front,
right,
or at the end of the day, you look at the bid is submitted and it's right in a certain amount and your efficiency is
right
what it is,
right,
and you then make a conscious decision right at that time whether you want to actually pursue that defense or not.
So it is waivable in that sense. You don't have to pursue it as a defense. The difference here is that, and I think the distinction you're doing is, can it be waived in advance? Can it be waived in a guarantee that's signed at the time of the transaction?
And our assertion is no, that it cannot be waived, because the distinction would be, and this would get to our public policy argument, in that if you waive it ahead of time, then you have a lender who already knows they're not going to be facing a deficiency argument, and therefore could then come to the foreclosure sale and bid whatever they wanted to bid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, be it low, be it high, and then create a high deficiency, and then therefore be potentially able to recover more than it's owed.
Right.
This was a situation in Chu versus Acacia Mutual Life Insurance Company,
right,
where the Supreme Court actually did find that situation existed,
and they found it unconscionable. Right.
They did in that case.
Right. Is the unconscionable? I agree that there's maybe a distinction between doing it in advance and doing it at the time of the actual deficiency proceeding. But does this eliminate all defenses that would be in your client's case? It may be because of broad language, but if they only waived this defense, would the unconscionability defense still be available? Would unequal bargaining power still be available? Would something that affects the document? And I am troubled by the fact that this is taking away the right of the borrower, giving free rein to the lender to bid whatever they want. But it seems to me there may be other protections which were not alleged in this case.
I think if you were going to waive your rights under 38-38-106, that would include the right to raise the defense that the bid was unconscionable. Because that's exactly what we do have here. We have a property that is of a value, and evidence was submitted that it was either from $3.7 million up to potentially $6.7 million. So it was a wide range of values. Much like in Chu, there was quite a range of values set forth in that case. And then $3.9 million was the low end. And then the bid came in at $3.7 million, leaving a $6 million deficiency, which was dramatically, or percentage-wise, quite different than the change or the percentage difference in CHU.
To the extent that there's an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing outside the statutory language, did you plead that in relationship only to the approval of the plat, or was it also pled in relationship to the refusal to lease?
In addition to the refusal to lease was also included in that, Your Honor.
Because I didn't see in the court's order, it seemed like they addressed the plat in regard to the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, but I didn't really see in the court's order where they considered that claim in connection with the failure to lease, or am I wrong about that?
I don't know if you're wrong on that, but I think what happened in that case, they just moved, since he found waiver, not only a waiver, but also that the documents contained the waiver and that they indeed had been waived by the Hicks, that they did not address that issue. So,
yeah, I guess that's my question is, even assuming that you can waive the statutory piece of it by virtue of the legislature not including non-waiver language, is it possible to waive the case law implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing? Are they separate sort of concepts to the extent that same waiver analysis may or may not apply?
I didn't believe they're separate concepts, and we did argue one of our issues on the appeal is the failure or the denial of our ability to recite, to assert the counterclaim for the breach of covenant, good faith and fair dealing.
But when you did file it, or whoever filed it, only alleged that breach with respect to the refusal to approve of the final plat. There's no mention in that amended counterclaim, proposed amended counterclaim, of the low bid, of the bid below market value, or any language that sounds like a breach of a duty of covenant of good faith.
I believe that the timing is important in this issue, because if the bid didn't come in until mid-March 2012, and I believe the motion to amend was filed before that.
And after the bid came in, and after the Hickses knew it was low, they didn't move to amend again to set forth another breach of covenant of good faith based on a low bid, or even to assert the defense under the statute, as I remember.
They did file a supplement to the motion, to the response to the motion for summary judgment based upon the low bid.
But not a pleading.
Other than the supplemental response, they didn't file a second amended complaint or second amended motion.
Right.
Because at that point in time, the case was proceeding on the motion for summary judgment.
Counsel, you have 2 minutes, 45 seconds remaining.
I will end it there. Save my rebuttal time if there's no more questions. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Steve Ryder. I represent the appellee in this case, Armed Forces Bank, at council table with my colleague, Mr. Bissell. Excuse me, my registration number is 7921. I would like to just take a few moments to discuss the facts in this case, and then I will address the three issues that I think are facing this court. Your Honors, the appellants in this case were sophisticated real estate developers in the Roaring Fork Valley and Aspen. They signed guarantee agreements so that they could get $8 million from the bank to build an office warehouse complex in Glenwood Springs. They signed guarantee agreements that contain detailed and explicit waivers of various rights, which I'll get into. This is not a consumer loan case where you have an unsuspecting person who has signed a document, and buried in the document is some waiver of their rights. The bank gave the appellants in this
case. Nor is it a home loan mortgage, which is very common, right? Can we draw a distinction? I mean, this is very troubling. Can we draw a distinction between the sophisticated lenders in this case and the home loan mortgage, or the consumer? Consumer wouldn't really be covered by this. The home loan mortgage situation, where individuals might be signing notes that have waivers, and then along comes the bank and does what Mr. Mulligan suggests they do, which has been very low. Can we draw a distinction, a principal distinction, based on this statute or the case language?
Well, in this case, it was a negotiated commercial loan that was, $8 million. It was carried out over three different years. It was renewed every year. These were not form documents. If you look at the last promissory note, these documents were drafted and negotiated. So I think, yes, you can distinguish that situation, which the trial court did, from the normal consumer loan situation where the consumer goes in, typically signs loan documents that are presented at a closing by the lender. And the trial court made that distinction in this case, saying that this was sophisticated businessman, that it was an $8 million commercial loan.
But what language in the statute suggests that it only be, that this, the waiver language, so to speak, only is applicable in a in a sophisticated loan transaction and it's not in a home loan transaction? In other words, if we agree with you and say this statute is allowed to be waived, does it open the floodgates to banks, mortgage lenders, to demand waivers in advance of the protections of the statute?
I don't think it opens the floodgates, Your Honor, but we are asking you to approve what the trial court did, which was say that these waivers were consciously given. They were given in a negotiated loan situation, and that based on the situation in this case, that they were valid, that the appellants recognized that they had waived these rights, and they never challenged the guarantee agreements. They never.
That it goes to the fact of whether they actually waived or not, and not the waivability in general?
In this case, and maybe to get to the point that you made in your question, I think if there is an unconscionable situation where there is an unconscionably low bid that's made in a foreclosure sale, and it is in a consumer loan document, that you could challenge the guarantee agreement. You could say that under the Uniform Consumer Credit Code, that is a provision that is unconscionable. But we don't have that situation here. This is governed by the Uniform Commercial Code and by the foreclosure statute. And it's not a consumer setting. So I think this doesn't deprive consumers of their right to come in and say, there was a waiver that I never realized that was buried deep into the in the loan documents.
Again,
they do have that protection under the UCCC.
I'm sorry, counsel, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Let me push on the parameters a little more just so that I can understand. It's again a hypothetical, and it's dealing with the sophisticated commercial lenders here. And I understand that there was an appraisal process that went on. But suppose there was nobody else that showed up at the foreclosure, and so the bank offered $1, and $1 was accepted. Would the lender be barred from waiving unconscionability under the agreement that we have here?
No, I don't think that the lender would be able to, in that situation, where you bid a dollar on a $6 million property or a $4 million property, I think that under the Chu decision, it's still an unconscionably low bid. In this case, that's simply not the case, because the lender ended up bidding almost $4 million on this property, the foreclosure sale.
There was a common law right. This statute basically, as I read it, codified the common law right that was discussed in Chu.
That's correct.
So the common law right may exist parallel to this right.
And if you look at the Chu decision, it was, I believe, a $1,000 bid on a property that was worth $100,000. Mm-hmm. But I would suggest that under the public trustee statute today, where you have publication of the sale, and you have a real estate market, like in this case, mm-hmm. in the Glenwood Springs area, Garfield mm-hmm. County, mm-hmm. that there are active bidding at foreclosure sales. Mm-hmm. There's spirited bidding, in fact, at some of these foreclosure sales. Also, the debtor retains the right to cure up to one day before the sale. And another protection built into the public trustee statute is that junior lienors can redeem from the sale by simply paying the amount that was bid at the sale to the lender. So if the lender, in this case, had bid a dollar, and there were junior liens on the property, one of those junior lieners could have come in and actually bid, taking the property for the amount of the bid.
And there's nothing that prevented the Hicks from bidding. In fact, they probably had an absolute right to bid or to redeem the property.
Sure, they could come to the sale and bid at the property. They could have cured before the sale.
Right.
The other point I would make about this is a national bank governed by federal law. This bank was acting under a consent order at the time that this foreclosure was done. That consent order required the bank to use appraisals that were approved by independent appraisers, and that they had to make credit decisions, including foreclosure bid decisions, based upon appraisals made by independent third parties. In this case, that's what happened. There was an independent appraisal review at the bank. and they approved the third-party appraisal and then made their bid based upon that appraisal. So I think there's protections that are built into the system, both from the Uniform Consumer Credit Code as well as to national banks. There's protection that they have to follow standard appraisal practices.
And in my hypothetical, I alluded to appraisals because I was trying to flesh that out a little bit to see if that provides some structure, almost requirement or perhaps a requirement that they come close to the appraisal number in their bidding process.
At least in this particular case, because this bank was subject to a comptroller currency order, they had to use an independent appraisal. And that's the law ever since 2010 when the regulations went into effect.
But of course, we never got to that stage of the case, whether that appraisal was...
Well, and that's because I think the court was correct in finding that the appellants in this case waived their rights. And I would like to just focus on that for just a second. The appellants in this case argue that the Colorado statute is not an anti-deficiency statute. The only support they supply for that is one California case. That's the Caravan case. But that case didn't hold that Colorado is not an anti-deficiency statute. What it simply held was that a lender in California could go outside of the California jurisdiction and seek a deficiency, and then that would not require the lender to cancel the note in California. That's all that case held. There is no case that says that Section 106 of our foreclosure statute is not an anti-deficiency statute. And I would suggest that it is an anti-deficiency statute and that was specifically waived in subparagraph A of the guarantee agreement.
I don't suppose anti-deficiency is defined anywhere in the guarantee, is it? Or the documents?
It's not defined in the guarantee, but I would say that the statute says that based upon the bid that's made by the lender at the foreclosure sale, a party who's obligated may raise a defense based upon the amount that the creditor bid in any deficiency action. The very language of Section 106 is to reduce the deficiency. It is against the deficiency. It is an anti-deficiency statute. In the Lichtenfeld's case, I think Your Honor hit the nail on the head on that, because in that case the court was dealing with a guarantee agreement that simply talked about the lender's duty to effect, protect, perfect, retain, or enforce any security. And that's totally different than the language we have in this case. In this case, the guarantee agreement in subparagraph A said that the guarantor waived any one action or anti-deficiency law or any other law which may prevent the lender from bringing any action, including a claim for deficiency. In subparagraph D, the guarantors waived any right to claim discharge of any indebtedness on the basis of unjustified impairment of the collateral. And under subparagraph F, they waived any defenses given to guarantors at law or in equity other than actual payment on the debt. And so it was broad enough to cover the defense under Section 106, but I think it was also specific enough to say that it was an anti-deficiency waiver and is a waiver of that defense that's provided by Section 106.
I suppose you'd also argue that in answer to Judge Boris's question, they waived the claim that the bank failed to act in good faith, if that's waivable. That's the issue's not before us, I suppose.
No, but I think the issue that they raised below in terms of the failure to lease the property, for example, that's an impairment of collateral. And I think under subparagraph D, they did waive that. And under the Crown Life case, which we cited in our brief, the Court of Appeals has said that a person can waive the impairment of collateral defense in the future. And so it is possible that in this case, the failure to lease kind of argument was one that they waived because of subparagraph D in the guarantee agreement. The second issue I think that's important is whether there can be a waiver, even if the waiver is effectuated in the guarantee agreement. And that's where I think the rule is pretty clear. Where the legislature grants a right, statutory right, in this case, a right to a defense in a foreclosure action on a deficiency. Unless the statute prohibits that right, or there is some strong countervailing public policy against the waiver of the right, then the person who is entitled to that right under the statute can waive it. And this is unlike the situation in May versus Women's Bank that the appellants cite in their brief, because there, the statute specifically says you can't waive the right. It says that in a UCC foreclosure situation, you can't waive the rights that protect the borrower, and in that case it was a guarantor. Instead, this is like the Franklin Building Corporation case where the Supreme Court said that you could waive the 3-day demand for payment in an eviction action. And Your Honors also pointed out that under Section 703 of the foreclosure statute, the legislature did say that you cannot waive the right to shorten the period of the cure or the right to cure in a foreclosure set. So if the legislature wanted to, they could amend Section 106 and prohibit the waiver, but they haven't done so, and they haven't done so at the time that this foreclosure was held.
According to the notes in my annotated statute, it appears that the language in our statute about assertion defense was actually modified and put in at the same time as the no-waiver language that Judge Roman referred to.
That's right. It was with the recodification of the foreclosure statute back in the early 1990s.
So in the same legislative proceeding, in one statute they put in no-waiver language, and in another statute they did not put any.
That is correct. The third issue, I think, also could be easily resolved. The appellants here argued, and it was clear at the time of the trial when they sought to amend their answer and assert a counterclaim, it was solely related to this concept about the bank's failure to sign off on the plat for the development of the property. This argument doesn't succeed for a number of reasons, but the most important is that the loan documents specifically required the filing of the plat by January 1, 2010. Now, the appellants cite the June 2009 forbearance agreement, and they say that this was an optional provision, that it wasn't required. But they ignore that subsequent to the forbearance agreement, there was a third amendment to the promissory note that specifically required the filing of the plat by January 1, 2010. At the same time, the third amendment also set a new maturity date. They missed both of those dates. They did not pay the loan when it matured, and they failed to file the plat by January 1, 2010.
Would you clarify the factual matter for me, maybe? I believe the language that they cite that says it should be done by January 10th appears in the, what do you call it,
there was a forbearance agreement that was entered into on June 2009. The forbearance agreement appears at the record at page 55. But then there was
the third modification of the note contains what appears to be more mandatory.
It is a mandatory. It says they shall file that plat by January 1, 2000.
So my question is only this. The copy we have in the record is undated. When was this third modification?
I believe it was in October of 2009.
Okay, thank you.
And I see my time is up. And does the court have any questions? I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Mulligan, you have 2 minutes and 35 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honors. Getting back to the issue of the sophisticated buyer, commercial real estate developers, that was referenced in the trial court's opinion, that because we did have sophisticated commercial real estate developers represented by counsel, but in no way did that decision limit itself to that situation. There's no limiting language that I find is only in situations that include sophisticated commercial real estate developers. And indeed, the trial court actually went on and said, I realize that the implication of this ruling could lead to misbehavior by lenders at foreclosure sales. And that is indeed what was trying to be protected by against that sort of activity, and including the potential for a lender to get more than what it was owed. And it goes back to your hypothetical, Your Honor. Conceivably, a lender could go and bid a dollar at the foreclosure sale, and because of a waiver in a loan document, under this scenario, that lender would be, I mean, that borrower would be precluded from arguing that it was an unconscionable bid because of the waiver that was contained in the loan documents. And that is the public policy issue that we're, that is at issue. And in May, they addressed public policy issues that precluded, or at least was trying to go against allowing lenders and other third parties from committing collusion and working together to the detriment of the borrowers in that case. With that, Your Honors, I would ask that the court reverse the trial court's decision.
Do you agree the third loan modification documents were signed in October of 2009?
I do not know that, Your Honor. I do not know that fact.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
And thank you both again for your fine arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.